Thank you for listening to this talk, produced by the Art Gallery of South Australia.
Hello, everyone. Welcome. Thank you so much for coming along. I want to start by acknowledging that we're meeting on the lands of the Kaurna people, Agsa Kaurna Yatunga Yuwandi. Agsa stands on Kaurna land. And we pay our respects to elders past, present, and emerging. And we've been really lucky with the Adelaide Biennial to work with many First Nations people. And it is just such a thrill to be able to share this space with the fabulous Tina Stefanam. I should introduce myself as well. So I'm Erin Davidson. I'm the project manager for the Adelaide Biennial. This is my fifth biennial, and this has been such an amazing treat to work on with Jose Da Silva. He's the curator who's based in Sydney, but was curator for this beautiful iteration of the 2024 Adelaide Biennial of Australian Art, Inner Sanctum. Tina's one of 24 artists and poets that Jose invited to be a part of this Inner Sanctum. She'll talk a little bit about her work, but I just wanted to start by saying that working with Tina has been an absolute honour and a privilege. Yes, yep, for those other AGSA staff that have had the chance to work with you. It's really your practice, the way you approach things, even just the conversations we've had have had a real impact on me personally and professionally. So I'm so glad you've made it today, because this is going to be an absolute treat to hear from Tina. And we'll do a plug for Tina's here for many reasons, obviously being in the biennial, but also she's been working incredibly hard with an amazing group of young performers based here in Adelaide over the last couple of months, probably six or more now, really big scheme of things, based yourself in Adelaide to produce a series. There's four performances happening this week, which we'll tell you a little bit more about later, called Dance the War of Proximity. But I'll hand over to Martin.
Thank you, Erin. Thanks, AGSA. It's such a privilege to be able to stand here as a voice of something in front of you. I'm just going to sit down with you because, I don't know, this feels too formal. Or maybe I should move over here. This feels better. Maybe I should move over here. Like, I don't know, this kind of staging is always strange. Yeah, I would also like to acknowledge that I've come from Wurundjeri country about an hour outside of Naam, and acknowledge that we are living in a time of immense grief and horror in witnessing what's happening in Palestine and to other First Nation people around the world. So just want to sit with that as a body in an institution. So here I am with you talking about an artwork that was produced, made, thought of, lived with, dreamed of for the past 10 years, really. I've been working with a herd of elderly horses that live about 11 minutes from my house. I met these beautiful creatures through a lovely equine guardian. Her name is Sukajawea, and we became really close friends. And she introduced me to these horses. And that introduction included a very natural occurrence of singing with them. As soon as I saw them, I felt compelled to make sound, probably as a means to say, I see you, I hear you, non-human creature, and I'm going to use non-verbal, non-human linguistical sounds to communicate that. So that was the first prompt. It wasn't in my mind at that time that I would be collaborating with them to create aesthetic objects for the public. It was a very relational and slow moving process. And I would say a healing, using the word healing in this is huge. I didn't grow up with horses. My family didn't introduce me to horses. I didn't go to pony club. I wasn't part of that socioeconomic strata that is usually associated to equine spaces. So it was much later in my life, or as an adult, that I was introduced to these four-legged creatures, and through voice and through sound. I eventually started to ride them, but I would say that the teenagers that I've worked with in this work are much more competent, confident horse riders than I am. So through my singing and making sound with these equine friends, these kin, I met the community that surrounds them. Sukajawea, who runs Jockleberry Farm, which is a horse sanctuary, she runs these sorts of people, but there is a very huge interest for young women, young female identifying people that come to the farm and do equine therapy through NDIS packages. So I had the opportunity to work with these young riders in their pony club and teach them certain vocalizations and breathing techniques that would increase their capacities for voice within their own bodies, but also increase their capacity to communicate with the horses. After all, how would the horses know where they stand with the human body if it wasn't for, hoo-hoo, slow down, nice, stop. If it wasn't for those vocalizations, how would they know? So some of these young horse riders had, they were extremely shy, as most people are when you talk about singing. If I was to ask any one of you, sing a song right now, I wonder what your first thought would be in your mind. Or if I was to isolate you and go, make sound beyond speech, extend a vowel, make a word longer than its moment of speech, I wonder what would come up in your mind. So it's amazing how we're using our voices all the time. Right now, I don't know what this isn't pre-scripted, I'm improvising with words to communicate. And if I just remove the word to communicate, then and it can go into music. But it's amazing how that distance between speech and singing, how big that is for most people. And why is that? Why is it we're born singing? We're born vocalizing beyond words, but there's a point in our education, in our conditioning, in our Western habitus, where we learn to talk and then we draw and we sing, and these are natural things we're mark making with our voices and with our bodies and with our line. And then we learn how to read and write, and we graduate from the pencil to the pen. And somewhere along that line, we stop singing as freely as we did beforehand, and we stop drawing as freely as we did beforehand. And for me, that's very interesting and somehow linked to what it is to be an adult, to become what I call bureaucratic. And so I could see those kind of bureaucratic tendencies already taking over some of these young people, in the sense that they felt really self-conscious in just making sound, which they were doing anyway through speech. But why is it that when we hum or make something nonsensical that we all of a sudden feel weird? What is it? Why? How? What a shame. What a limitation of such a huge spectrum of personal liberation and collective exploration. So through these workshops with these amazing young people, through 4 years of attending their pony clubs on the weekend, and singing with the horses, breathing with the horses, and finding these new techniques, because we were developing them in situ. They're not predetermined. This is not something that was pre-written. We're developing it together, in place, in time, with voice, with body, through many different weathers, cold, hot, etc. And that would also alter in the way in which we constructed voice. But it was through these 4 years of continuous relational engagement that I watched them go from giggly, very, very shy, almost to the point where it was like no sound was coming out, to the end, creating artwork that you actually have the privilege to witness in the next room. They actually were developing their own sonic languages together. So they've co-composed this work in the sense that we were improvising with sounds that they were exploring in real time, that through the years they got past seeing them as silly and started seeing them as useful. And also that's a big distance between the abstract and the kind of unknown to the useful, the pragmatic, and therefore the expressive. So that is the kind of process that I've been going on with these amazing young horse riders. nurses whom some have passed away now, because it's been 10 years, and they're being rehabilitated and cared for at Jockleberry Farm. And watching the relationship between coming-of-age bodies and consciousness with end-of-life bodies in another form is also very beautiful. The care that was just so naturally expressing itself beyond discourse, beyond the need to prove that anyone cares, that relationship between the elderly horse, the horse that is on its last legs, and the coming of age of these young women is very profound. And unfortunately, pony clubs are painted in certain cliches or certain light, but I don't actually know why, because I was never part of one. I suspect that because it's so common in certain socioeconomic echelons, or maybe because it's predominantly girls, that there is a bit of a kind of disregard to it. And so I was very curious as to understand the technologies that exist between these two cliched bodies. And I say this in the program, but just adjacent to the cliché is the sacred, and I really witness that in being with these creatures. What else can I tell you? I suppose I prefer to make this a dialogue. I feel like I'm ranting. Is there anything that I've said that tickles you? Or anything? Yeah, questions? Yeah. Great question. Thank you. So, the process from going from, you know, cleaning poo and hooves and singing on horses on a rainy Saturday morning to dressing the girls in costumes and, being in front of a camera. The camera is also an interesting apparatus in this. It's another site of capture, another historical lens, very linked to the zoological gaze. The way it's evolved has been through exercises with animals, particularly the horse. That has a huge role in the history of the camera. So the focus or the process from the site workshops to the night, the couple of nights where we did the filming documentation of the performance. I mean, it's really, oh God, there's so many parts to this. So there's costume, and it's at nighttime. They're wearing a costume that's got light that's inbuilt, so it actually made visibility a little bit challenging, because you can't, when you've got the light flooding in front of your eyes, it's hard to see too far ahead. But that work that we had done with, over those years, with singing and with the horses, had almost like they, at times they really didn't need their eyes. They're really just sensing movement and voice. So that became the visual apparatus, was like tactility and motion. So they're already really gauged for that. I would put the costume on and test it myself and ride. So it also desensitized the horses to the fabric over many months. So it's a very iterative phase with lots of different moments of trying things and making sure that the materials, the sonic, the spatial, and then the filmic are all working together in care. So we filmed this over three nights with a team, a wonderful cinematographer called Will Normile, and him and I have been working together for a long time, and he also came to visit the site many times to get a feeling. Also, of course, had equine specialists there, and the teens themselves, they were also like not only the performers, but they're also the caretakers. So we were all working together to make sure that people got on the horses okay, we got the costumes on all right. And you'll actually see in the work, there's probably a 6-minute sequence. So you're actually watching the girls dress each other and get on top of the horse. So it's very transparent. The work itself isn't choreographed to present a finished product, so to speak, even though it is outcoming. You actually do see the process in the work itself. So what's interesting is what a practice opens up. So for me, the aesthetic object is important to communicate to the populace, but it's actually what it opens post this stuff. And what it has opened is... some are doing more singing work now. Some are doing more performing work now who weren't beforehand. Some of even their relationship with the horses have gotten deeper. So if there were any kind of moments of vulnerability or unknownness, we worked through that and came out on the other side really beautifully, where they've become more confident and they're becoming leaders in this hybrid way. I mean, some of them had never used their voice like this before, or even thought they would be dressed up like a jellyfish in the middle of the Victorian bush. You know, like, it's a strange, surreal moment for them, but that's only increased their capacity for imaginative possibilities beyond the norm of the Pony Club. So that's what I've received from them. And then the sacredness. I'll get to the sacredness. Well, I mean, it's funny, the term sacredness. For me, it's not a hierarchical thing. It's not religious. The work itself, pictorially, is very much influenced by Byzantine al fresco paintings in Greek Orthodox churches. The colours, the compositions, the idea of sainthood, slaying beasts. You see in these religious paintings that there's usually a horse involved. The four horsemen of the apocalypse. There's so many horse puns. Our language is actually full of them. Take stock of that. You know, they're everywhere. So that sacredness that the kind of expected sacredness of religiosity that is seen, I wanted to make an image that was anti-transcendent, in the sense that instead of looking at saints and heroes and mythological, good versus evil, I wanted to create an anti-transcendental image that honoured elderly horses and young local girls, making it really imminent and of here and now, that honours the sacredness of everything, not just the prescribed hierarchies of humanism that has been passed down and normalised. So the sacredness for me is in the relation, is in the process, is in the discovery of things yet unknown, and in the making ready for things to come. And that, for me, is really potent in working with teenage bodies and people. Okay.
Homo sapiens abused horse more than most animals. And your inspiring speech reminded me how I once shared a house with a horse. I was renting a barn in rural Maryland. And the owner, so the horse was not in my bedroom, but it was 10 meters away. And the owner of the house had a habit of turning the radio on for the horse all night long. So I could hear this radio because I was so close. So I tolerated it for a few nights, and then one night I just went to the horse and turned the radio off, which I could, but the horse couldn't. Now,
that agency, are you talking? How do we know? I know. Yeah. Yeah, yeah. How can you know? How can we know? Sometimes we can't even know with humans, right? So I suppose not to universalize sensorial experience is important, to think beyond neuronormativity, to think of the habitus of normativity, that's more important. I think that's a really essential thing, considering that also some of the girls I was working with would call themselves neurodiverse. You don't know. So for me, it's about earning the right. What do we owe each other? How do we honour the unknown? And for me, it was really just working with the horses every week, getting to know them, time. And through that, certain permissions seem to have been made, and I'm sure I also effed it up too. There has to be room for mistake and learning. Staying around long for the learning. Because to think you know it is to be human-centric. I don't. So that's my answer. Any other questions? Yes. Do you need a microphone? Thank you. Yes, I should do a plug, because I could really sit here for hours. This could be an endurance work. So, I have such a privileged, I've been having the most wonderful, fulfilling experience beyond art, beyond awards, beyond exhibition with these Adelaide youth performers. They are superb. They are showing us something else for what's to come. They are sensitive, they are caring, and they are using improvisation as in such a sophisticated way. And some of them have never done work like this before, so it just shows you that it's already there. So we are performing. There's 12 of us. We've got Jasmine is one of them here. She's in the work. She's sitting with us today. And Alice, who's a dancer, who's also participating in the work, is here with us today. And I'm so lucky to have them. We are working across 4 iconic sites in Adelaide. I didn't want to just show a video work and leave Adelaide. I was curious as what happens if an artist stays around. Instead of being a FIFO, fly in, fly out, I wanted to know, well, what's the work going to do with the city? And how would I know if I'm not present? So I have the privilege and of time and space to spend time in Adelaide, and this is where I've met these wonderful performers. And so over 4 days, we'll be moving through these 4 iconic sites, sites of exhibition and surveillance. We start at the summit, Mount Lofty Summit, where there's a huge diverse public there, all sorts of different types of people from all sorts of different walks of life who come to visit a view, which I find really interesting, and this panoramic spread and this kind of distance between human and nature and then city and then ocean. Like, it's quite interesting. So that's day one. Day two, we go to the Botanic Gardens, classic, the kind of colonial stronghold of plant conservation and trying things out. It's got a deep history in that. And then we go to the zoo, an interesting site. Same thing, the zoo is a stage and very linked to, as I said before, the history of cinema, the state. There's all sorts of things going on with that. And having, you know, 12 people moving differently to what's going on in there is quite surreal, and it makes the already strange stranger, which I think is important. I think the strange is important. And then we end here, site of exhibition and acquisition and valuation, and we actually end in front of We Are All Flesh, which is, I'm sure you know it, the 2 taxidermy horses. So we end there. And I see the performers as a metaphorical nervous system that's enacting certain functions through sound and movement and collective improvisational technologies. I call them technologies, technicities. And they're building their own they've self-organized this system. I've given them workshops where we've explored, with Lily and Alice, we've explored different movement languages and different vocalities of making sound. And again, similar process to that I've worked with the teenagers in Hymenols, spending time exploring breath, tone, the difference between an open sound, is different to, and they all have relationships to the nervous system, deregulating it, making it want to go fight or flight, etc., etc. So there's many layers to the work, and they are uncollectible objects in sites of very, I think, troubled and problematic ways of thinking of value. That doesn't mean I don't celebrate these sites. I just think we can hold both. So that starts tomorrow at midday at Mount Lofty Summit. It'd be so wonderful for the ensemble to have the gift of a sensitive gaze. So if you felt like joining us, we'd to have you. And let's, shall we end on a hum? A collective hum? Shall we do it? So taking a deep breath in, breathing out, breathing in, breathing out, breathing in. Let's change it to an R. See if you can make a little melody. Thank you so much. What a privilege.